You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Skin in the Game by Michelle Ruiz. The cowboys, who had originally recast the cheerleaders as objects of sexual desire, lashed out when others tried to capitalize on their newly sexualized image. Dallas spent an estimated $1 million suing the distributor of the porn film Debbie Does Dallas over unauthorized use of what looked like a DCC uniform. The team also successfully sued Playboy photography Arnie Freitag for making the poster featuring the topless Texas cowgirls. The lawsuits weren't about protecting the cheerleaders from unwanted exposure. They were about protecting the team's brand. As Freitag recalls, "I had to sit there and listen to the Cowboys' lawyer saying, 'Our cheerleaders are schoolteachers, and they're churchgoers, and how dare this guy sexualize our group of perfect, innocent young women?' And I'm like, 'Wait a minute. You can't put them in these little skimpy outfits and have no problems with TV cameras being up their skirts half the time on the football field and blame me for it. That's pretty hypocritical.'" Or, as Playboy observed in a statement defending the disbanded Chargettes, "The Chargers and other teams have wrapped these enthusiastic young ladies up like candy every weekend on national television. All we did is ask them to remove the wrapping." The cheerleaders themselves understood what was at stake. "It's an issue of ownership and power," says Schilling. "Anything that takes away from their power and control is threatening to them. When we were featured in Playboy, it was a bad reflection on management." The key difference between Dallas and Playboy was one of audience. The Cowboys, who operate in the heart of the Bible Belt, were careful to package the cheerleaders to appeal to male fans without drawing the ire of their wives or ministers. "The Cowboys weren't dummies," says Cohen, the Playboy editor. "Here they had big hair, big boobs, bouncy, smiley young women parading up and down the sidelines. They were well aware of what was necessary to get them the notoriety they were looking for, to drive ticket holders, drive eyeballs to TV, drive advertisers. They knew exactly what was going on. Sex might sell, but when it came to the cheerleaders, the message was clear. The only ones allowed to sell it were the NFL's owners." Ironically, as the years passed, the NFL shifted in Playboy's direction. Over the next three decades, the cheerleaders found their uniforms getting skimpier and skimpier. Hot pants made hotter with V-shaped dips at the waist. Seductive posters gave way to swimsuit calendars and lingerie calendars. The pay, on the other hand, remained as low as ever, even as the league's profits soared. In 1995, one squad of cheerleaders decided to do something about it. The Buffalo Jills became the first and only squad to unionize, demanding better pay and equal treatment. "We were just tired of being used and abused," says Aaron McCormick Oliver, a co-captain who helped spearhead the unionization drive. "We were unique, intelligent, talented women, and we wanted to be respected for that." The Jills, who were paid nothing at the time but one ticket per home game and a parking pass, managed to negotiate a paycheck of $25 per home game or personal appearance. But the victory proved short-lived. The squad's sponsor, Mighty Taco, dropped the Jills after they unionized. "Just being professional was a bridge too far for them," Oliver recalls. A local restaurant owner eventually agreed to step in on one condition: the Jills must drop their union affiliation. Without the protection of collective bargaining, the Jills once again found themselves at the mercy of the owners. "We were back at square one," says Oliver, who left the squad in 1999. In 2014, the Jills made news again when they became one of the first NFL squads to sue for back pay. The Oakland Raiderettes, who also sued, reached a settlement awarding them $1.25 million in back pay, or approximately $6,000 per cheerleader. But like the Chargettes before them, the Jills discovered that speaking up carried a heavy price. Rather than settle, Buffalo simply disbanded the squad. 4 years later, the case is still inching its way through the courts. It's impossible to determine how much money the NFL makes off its cheerleading squads. The sale of swimsuit calendars, posters, and other cheerleading merchandise represents a relatively tiny source of revenue for most teams, according to Ray Katz, who worked as the NFL's director of marketing for 15 years. The chief money-making potential is corporate sponsorships for cheerleading squads, deals that can draw as much as $500,000 for a blue-chip organization like the Dallas Cowboys. Given the league's outsized wealth, Katz says, it's a terrible business practice to be paying cheerleaders as little as $25 for a two-hour appearance. He says the league should provide cheerleaders with a fair wage for game day performances and create a clear revenue-sharing plan for personal appearances. In a sense, the true value of the cheerleader is woven into the very fabric of the NFL. The league profits from selling a retrograde notion of masculinity. Big, strong men, unafraid to take a hit, surrounded by enthusiastic, scantily clad women. In this model, paying cheerleaders next to nothing isn't just a way to keep costs down. It's an essential part of the NFL's brand. The cheerleaders don't do it for the money. They do it because they love the team. They are where they belong on the sidelines, ready and willing at every moment to support the Warriors who are battling for supremacy on the field. That's why, 40 years after the NFL decided to market cheerleaders as sex objects, it continues to police the personal appearance of squad members. Bailey Davis, the Saints cheerleader who was fired for posting an Instagram photo in a lacy bodysuit, says she was told it was trashy and inappropriate. "Meanwhile, I'm posing for the team's swimsuit calendar, and they're making money off of it." On the other end of the spectrum, Kristen Ann Ware, a cheerleader with the Miami Dolphins, clashed with the team for being too chaste. In a lawsuit against both the Dolphins and the NFL, Ware alleges that team management ordered her to stop discussing the fact that she is a virgin who is waiting until marriage to have sex because of her Christian faith. "We're just trying to help you develop into a real woman," Ware says she was told. The Dolphins say they do not discriminate on the basis of gender or religion. Cheerleading alumni from the old days note that the outfits and routines have become more risque than ever. "To me, they dance like a bunch of strippers," says Kepley, the former Cowboys cheerleader. "They're twerking on TV. It feels like lighting dynamite. When's it going to explode?" The NFL, for its part, is exploring ways to turn back the clock. Over the summer, representatives of the 26 teams that have cheerleading squads were summoned to a closed-door meeting with NFL brass to discuss the recent rash of lawsuits and allegations. In a reversal of what teams set out to do with cheerleaders in the 1970s, the league discussed making their image less saucy and more family-friendly, according to a source familiar with the meeting. Some teams are traveling even further back in time. This fall, the Rams and the Saints debuted the first male cheerleaders in NFL history. But teams continue to profit from marketing their cheerleaders as sex objects. A reality show on CMT called Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders Making the Team, now in its 13th season, manufactures drama from body-shaming young hopefuls trying out for the DCC. Candidates with 20% body fat, well within the normal range for a healthy woman, are pressured to lose weight. In one episode, a team-hired body image expert pinches the belly of a slender woman with flat abs. "You don't want to put that body into that little tiny uniform," he tells her. The NFL's approach to cheerleading is out of sync with the future of cheerleading itself. Competitive cheerleading, a demanding sport that requires the athleticism and skill of professional gymnastics, has soared in popularity over the past decade. Today, there are 1.25 million competitive cheerleaders in the United States, with competitions broadcast on E-SPAN to 100 million homes in 32 countries. As someone who has been part of the cheerleading community my whole life and is immersed in advancing the sport, the recent wave of allegations from NFL cheerleaders has been upsetting, says Nicole Locher, a spokesperson for the Universal Cheerleaders Association, the sport's top organization. However, in many cases, what these women are doing is not what we consider modern-day cheerleading. They're entertainers. The former cheerleaders, gathered at the reunion in Nashville, don't dispute that characterization. Many got into cheerleading because they enjoyed the way it made them feel about themselves. They did it, they say, for the same reason women rush sororities, for the gossip sessions and the post-breakup shoulders to cry on amid the clouds of hairspray in the locker room. What they remember most isn't the way they were harassed or exploited or shamed. It's the sense of sisterhood they felt. When people ask me if I would do it again, I always say absolutely, says Kilmer, the Cowboys cheerleader who was ordered to lose weight in her thighs. It was one of the best experiences of my life. Even Davis, who was fired by the Saints, speaks fondly of the way her Saintsations sisters would huddle together and support each other through all the abuse and the discrimination and the lousy pay. "This is horrible. I'm not coming back next year," she recalls grousing with her squad mates. "And then we kept coming back for each other." Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Patricia Arquette, the star of Showtime's Escape and Dannemora on Midlife Crises and Motherhood. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Hanging out with my kids and all my friends and family. What is your greatest fear? Burying people I love. Which historical figure do you most identify with? I admire a lot of historical figures, but the people I most identify with are those who don't become famous. They're moms and other normal people. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? My PTSD. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Lying and a lack of morals and ethics. I'm not very good at singular answers, sorry. What is your greatest extravagance? When I was turning 40, I bought a Porsche. The fact that I was doing it kind of repulsed me, and I realized I was having a midlife crisis. But 10 years later, I still drive that car every day, and I love it. What is your favorite journey? I am really digging this whole journey. It's bloody and raw at times, but in general, I am grateful for the whole ride. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Beauty. What do you dislike most about your appearance? I'm actually just trying to go with the groove of getting older and be happy celebrating the phases of the human experience. If there was a drug made tomorrow that made you live forever looking like your 20-year-old self, I wouldn't take it. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I would take better care of myself, not so that I could look different outwardly to the world, but so I wasn't stressed out. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? My mom and dad and sister passed away, so I guess I would have them all be alive. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? I would be a little Persian cat, a white one that never grew past the kitten phase. I could fit in the palm of your hand for my whole life. What is your favorite occupation? Being a mom. What is the quality you most like in a man? I think the strongest quality a man can have is to be gentle. It takes incredible strength to endure life and still be gentle. And ethics are really important to me and partners. Strength, gentleness, and integrity. And humor. I told you I can't give a singular answer. What is the quality you most like in a woman? The same qualities I love in men. Not that men and women are the same, but I love those qualities in all people. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? I love the story that we know about Jesus, and I do believe Jesus lived, but there's a lot more to the Jesus story. I think there are aspects of it that are historical fiction, and there's so much missing from the story that I'll never know. I'll never stop wondering what that all was. Who are your heroes in real life? I love Martin Luther King Jr., and I love Jesus, and I love my boyfriend, and my family, and my kids, and my friends. How would you like to die? Peacefully in my sleep. Before I get really sick, no long illness. I don't want to die in a hospital. What is your motto? I wish I had one. A motto, I mean. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Patricia Arquette. Solomon's Dilemma. Goldman Sachs became the poster child for Wall Street greed. Can its new CEO find a way to satisfy Main Street's needs? By William D. Cohen. Photographs by Landon Nordman. Opening photo, on the money. David Solomon was caught off guard when Lloyd Blankfein told him he would be taking over as CEO. "I needed a moment to collect myself," he says. And in the opening photo, David Solomon is shown standing beside his desk, looking off to the side, and he's wearing a suit, but no tie. After lunch on March 1st, David Solomon was standing at his desk in his 41st floor office at Goldman Sachs, high above the Hudson River, answering emails and talking on his telephone headset. For the previous 15 months, Solomon had been locked in a competition with Harvey Schwartz, with whom he served as co-chief operating officer at Goldman for one of the most coveted positions on Wall Street. One of them would be picked to succeed Lloyd Blankfein, the bank's chairman and CEO, whenever he decided the time had come to step down. Suddenly, Blankfein yelled to Solomon from his office next door. "Can you come here?" the boss called. "I want to talk to you about something." Solomon walked into Blankfein's office, just as he had hundreds of times before, but this visit was different. "The board has made a decision," Blankfein told him without preamble. "You're going to be my successor. I'm going to talk to Harvey about it in the next couple of days, but I just wanted to tell you that." Solomon was flabbergasted. He had no idea that Blankfein had decided to retire, let alone that the board had already met to approve him as CEO. "I thought I was doing a good job, but I didn't think that he was leaving," Solomon tells me. "I needed a moment to collect myself." It took Solomon nearly 24 hours before he could think straight again. Even more disorienting was the fact that he could not share the news with anyone outside the firm, including his family, for another 9 days, when the bank would announce the transfer of power. He spoke with Schwartz, who offered his congratulations. "He was disappointed that it wasn't him," Solomon recalls, "but he was very generous and humble." Widely seen as a steady hand who helped reinvigorate the investment banking business at Goldman, Solomon represents a sharp shift from Blankfein, a risk manager known for placing big calculated bets. In 2007, Blankfein netted the firm $4 billion by authorizing a big short against the mortgage market, and in 2009, in the midst of the global financial meltdown, he led Goldman to its best year ever, raking in nearly $20 billion in pre-tax profits. But those freewheeling days are over. In the post-crash regulatory environment, despite some rollbacks by the Trump administration, Washington continues to actively discourage Wall Street risk-taking. It falls to Solomon, who stepped into the CEO job on October 1st, to navigate Goldman through the intricacies of the new landscape, a task Blankfein more or less abdicated in hopes that the pendulum would swing back to a more permissive era. By necessity, Solomon will be forced to adopt a strategy that is much more staid and likely less profitable than the one Blankfein forged. It's a role he's particularly suited for, having worked at a handful of Wall Street banks that no longer exist. Solomon has seen firsthand that past performance is no guarantee of future results. He's got no shortage of challenges, but it is an amazing franchise and the brand is great, says Jonathan Gray, president of the Blackstone Group, who has known Solomon for years. "If somebody asks, would I bet on Goldman Sachs under David Solomon's leadership? Absolutely." Solomon is cut from a classic Goldman mold. in the sense that, like many of the firm's leaders before him, he's an ambitious middle-class striver. One of three business-minded brothers, he grew up north of New York City in Westchester County, where he attended Edgemont High School. His father owned a small printing business, and his mother sold hearing aids. In his high school yearbook picture, Solomon is seated on a large boulder, sporting a mop of dark hair parted down the middle, monkey style. Like Blank Fine and Hank Paulson before him, Solomon now embraces his baldness, which has become something of a Goldman signature. His yearbook quotes foreshadow both his work ethic, Emerson, the success of a job well done is to have done it, and his self-reliance, Thoreau, what a man thinks of himself, that is what determines, or rather indicates, his fate. After majoring in political science at Hamilton College, Solomon was rejected by Goldman for a 2-year analyst position, so he headed to One Wall Street, where he spent a year in the training program at Irving Trust, now part of Bank of New York Mellon. "You basically went to graduate school at the bank for a year," he recalled in a Goldman podcast. Afterward, in 1986, he moved to Drexel Burnham Lambert, the investment bank made infamous by junk bond pioneer Michael Milken, where he received an education of a different kind. Meetings with Milken began at 6 a.m. in New York City, which was 3 a.m. in Los Angeles, where Milken lived. Solomon marveled at Milken's energy. As a 25-year-old, this was an entrepreneurial place where you were given an awful lot of rope, Solomon says. If you were good and took the opportunities you were given, you could excel incredibly quickly. Drexel allowed him to interact with CEOs in ways he could not have done at a more traditional firm. He sold commercial paper and then high-yield junk bonds, the financial instruments favored by companies with less than stellar credit ratings. "It really got me fired up about finance," Solomon said on the podcast. But throughout Solomon's time at the firm, Milken faced allegations of insider trading and racketeering. In 1990, after pleading guilty to lesser charges, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison and fined $600 million. Drexel, slapped with a fine of $650 million, the largest ever levied under the Depression-era securities laws, filed for bankruptcy and went out of business. Today, Solomon remains friendly with Milken. When Solomon's father was diagnosed with prostate cancer, Milken would call regularly to check in and see if he could help. What Solomon took away from his experience at Drexel wasn't Milken's penchant for risky deals, but his discipline. His work ethic and the way he processed information and the way he read and absorbed, it was extraordinary. And it still is, Solomon says. You see him today, you go to his office, and there are papers everywhere that he's read and marked up. He's got an incredible ability to digest information and then synthesize it and communicate around it. In 1991, after a brief stint as a vice president at Salomon Brothers, Solomon moved to Bear Stearns as managing director of the bankruptcy and high-yield bond group. He quickly rose through the ranks. In 1995, at age 33, Bear named him co-head of investment banking. As a boss, he was tough but respected. Some people who didn't meet his standards disliked him, says a former Bear executive, but he was the real deal. Next, photos, day in the life. Solomon makes the rounds at Goldman's headquarters in New York City, speaking at a weekly market huddle and visiting the asset management floor. Ironically, Solomon's new position at Bear Stearns inadvertently paved his way to Goldman. In 1997, Baer and Goldman were the lead underwriters for the Venetian Casino and Resort in Las Vegas, which was being developed by business magnate Sheldon Adelson. Solomon co-headed the Baer team, while John Winkelried, now the president of TPG Capital, led the Goldman team, along with Steven Mnuchin, currently serving as Treasury Secretary. Winkelried quickly came to admire Solomon's judgment, his command of the facts, and his willingness to be a team player. He was very collaborative, Winkelried says. In January 1999, after an elaborate closing dinner for the deal at a resort in Cancun, Solomon and Winkelried flew back together to New York on the same flight. "You should really come to Goldman Sachs," Winkelried urged. Solomon, by then one of the top executives at Bear Stearns, demurred. "I really don't think I would do that," he said. But Winkelried persisted, repeatedly inviting Solomon to dinner and making the case for moving to Goldman. Winkelried even offered Solomon a partnership, one of the few times Goldman had bestowed the coveted position upon an outsider. The wooing was extraordinary. "It's generally more difficult to get a job at Goldman than to gain admission to Harvard." But Solomon was still ambivalent. "I was really reluctant," he recalls. "It was a big, big decision. It wasn't like I was dying to work at Goldman." Then one day, in the midst of the full court press from Goldman, Solomon had what he calls a bad interaction with Jimmy Cain, the longtime CEO of Bear Stearns. To grow the business, Solomon wanted to hire a senior banker from Merrill Lynch, but he needed Cain to sign off on offering the recruit enough Bear stock to match the unvested shares he would lose if he left Merrill. Cain wouldn't do it, and Solomon returned to his office, peeved. The phone rang. It was Winkelried. "Are you coming to Goldman Sachs?" he asked yet again. Solomon agreed to meet the firm's top brass, and he came away impressed. He also consulted with Blankfein, whom he knew socially from the Hamptons. Finally, after a dinner with John Thornton, then the co-president of Goldman, Solomon told his wife, "I'm going to go to Goldman Sachs." In September 1999, after discussing the move for several weeks with Bear Stearns, Solomon joined Goldman. "It was their gain and our loss," Warren Spector, a former co-president of Bear, would recall years later. But Solomon's ambivalence about joining Goldman cost him, at least initially. Had he joined the firm that May, before its initial public offering, he would have hit the financial jackpot like the rest of Goldman's partners, some of whom were suddenly worth $300 million. "If I had really understood the economics of the IPO," he says, "I probably would have come sooner." He sold his Bear stock well before the firm went under in 2008, though, and his Goldman stock is now worth around $47.5 million. Last year, before being named CEO, he made $21 million in total compensation. Next photo, night moves. Solomon DJs at the Electronic Music Awards. "It's really humanized me," he says. "Young people talk to me in a way they didn't before." Goldman being an insular culture, there was always the chance of organ rejection. "If somebody came in and didn't roll up their sleeves, that could happen," Winkelried says. "But David wasn't like that. David was a hard worker. He had something to add, and he very quickly found himself at home." Over the next 12 years, mentored by Winkelried, Solomon rose through the ranks. First as head of Goldman's financing businesses, then as co-head of investment banking, and finally as co-chief operating officer alongside Harvey Schwartz. The initial betting inside Goldman was that the CEO job was Schwartz's to lose. "It's not like my ears were closed," says Solomon. "I heard that too." Blank Fine, according to one former longtime executive at the firm, was impressed by Schwartz's performance as chief financial officer. Harvey was crushing it, the executive says. He handled everything well. Earnings calls, regulators, investor relations, the board. Lloyd felt like, well, look at this guy. But over time, according to the executive, the stress of the situation began to weigh on Schwartz. He became monomaniacal and uncomfortable with surrendering control. Many inside the firm came to see him as a control freak. He is said to believe that some people at Goldman conspired against his candidacy. Schwartz declined to comment, but a source familiar with his thinking called such characterizations simply not accurate. Whatever his state of mind, Schwartz decided he needed to know whether it was going to be him or Solomon who would succeed Blank Fine. He called the question with the board, only to discover that he didn't have either Blank Fine's or the board's support. He did not handle the situation particularly well, says a former Goldman partner who is close to Schwartz. If Lloyd had another 4 or 5 years to go, it could have played out quite differently, because Harvey is actually much better externally than people give him credit for. With no way forward, Schwartz decided to leave Goldman. Solomon says he wishes Schwartz had agreed to stay, but concedes he would have left the firm too had he been passed over for the top job. He declines to say whether he thinks he played the situation smarter than Schwartz. My approach to it was very, very simple, he says. I was excited to be the co-president of Goldman Sachs. If the firm thought that I'd be the best guy to run the firm, I'd be excited to have the opportunity to do it. If the firm didn't think I was the best guy to run the firm, I'd go to something else. It wasn't defining me. Love it or hate it, Goldman Sachs has always displayed an uncanny knack for finding the right man at the right time to lead the firm. Sometimes the right man is a banker. Sometimes the right man is a trader. The right man has never been a woman. First, it was the indomitable investment banker Sidney Weinberg who saved the firm after the stock market crash in 1929. Then it was Gus Levy, who expanded Goldman's banking franchise into trading, making a fortune for himself and his partners along the way. Then it was Robert Rubin, later a Treasury Secretary, Steve Friedman, later a National Economic Advisor, John Corzine, later a Governor and Senator, and Hank Paulson, who rescued the firm twice, first as a rainmaker, then as Treasury Secretary during the financial crash in 2008. Each of them found ways for Goldman to make more and more money, regardless of the prevailing market conditions. But Solomon faces a challenge that no Goldman leader before him has been forced to confront. Ever since 2008, when the Federal Reserve took the unprecedented step of making Goldman a bank holding company and giving it access to its short-term borrowing window following the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, Goldman has effectively been subjected to the same financial regulations as big commercial banks. And despite the recent loosening of banking rules under Trump, Solomon doesn't see much regulatory relief on the horizon. It's evolving, he says, but it's not going away. So Solomon is planning to reposition Goldman in a way that his predecessors would have found not just unthinkable, but downright distasteful. He's moving the storied investment bank increasingly into commercial banking, offering cash management to its corporate clients, and small loans to average Americans to help them pay off their credit card debt. The move represents a subtle but decisive shift away from the early part of the Blank Fine era, when Goldman made the bulk of its profits from trading and from making high-stakes proprietary bets, like the one against the housing market. David understands well that you can't out Lloyd Lloyd, says the former longtime Goldman executive. He's not going to be Lloyd. He's going to move as far away as possible from that, and that's smart. In time, all of Goldman's risk prowess will go by the wayside, and we will just be a commercial bank. Though it won't be opening any bank branches, Goldman has already made a big bet on Marcus, its online consumer loan business, named after the firm's founder. At Solomon's direction, it has more than tripled its corporate loan portfolio to $100 billion. It has also made Goldman Sachs Bank USA more of a priority, offering interest rates well beyond those of its deposit-rich adversaries like J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Morgan Stanley. Solomon expects such moves into commercial banking to add $2 billion to Goldman's annual revenues, on par with what the firm forecast the coming increase to be from investment banking. I want to make Goldman more durable, he says. We're thinking about how we diversify the footprint and add more for our clients over time. There's a certain irony in Goldman's pivot toward Main Street. In the aftermath of the global financial crisis, Goldman came to symbolize everything that many Americans find distasteful about Wall Street. The self-interest, the rapacious greed, the preoccupation with finding new ways to make money. Goldman's sterling reputation took a serious hit. We got knocked around a bit, Solomon acknowledges. But the new emphasis on commercial banking doesn't mean that Goldman is abandoning its traditional strengths. Underwriting securities and advising clients on mergers and acquisitions. One of the first things Solomon did, after being named CEO, in fact, was to hit the road to meet some of the firm's biggest clients. He went to London. He went to Sweden. He went to China. I'm going to have to make an investment, he figures, and build my own relationships with these people. High on his list for a personal visit was Mohammed bin Salman Al Saud, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. In May, Solomon went to Riyadh to meet MBS, as the prince is known, with Dina Powell, the former Deputy National Security Advisor, who had organized President Trump's extravaganza to Saudi Arabia last year. Powell had just returned to Goldman as a partner, one of only seven women on the firm's 33-member management committee, to head up the firm's efforts to do business with sovereign wealth funds. MBS, you are the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, she said in introducing him to Solomon, and David, you are the Crown Prince of Goldman Sachs. It will be good for you two to get to know each other. Solomon and MBS had 40 minutes together. He's extremely impressive, Solomon says. He's got a lot of energy. He's passionate about what he's doing. He's very, very engaged in what he's trying to accomplish. And he's trying to change his country, which has an impact on the world for the better. Solomon told MBS that Goldman's capital, its network of relationships around the world, and its premier advisory business could be very valuable as the prince executes on his 2030 vision plan to turn Saudi Arabia into a global investment powerhouse and to reduce its dependence on the production of fossil fuels. The day before we met in his office, Solomon was in Jeddah for a meeting with top Saudi ministers to hear how they intended to meet the 2030 goals. The ministers are very compelling in the story that they articulate, he emailed Blankfein afterward as he headed home on the company's private jet. But you've got to execute, and the execution's going to be hard. Another of his major priorities as CEO, Solomon says, is to attract more women and people of color to Goldman. While we have made progress in recent years on women's representation and ethnic and racial diversity, there is still significant progress to be made, Blankfein and Solomon wrote in a March memo. But some who understand the dynamics at the firm doubt that Solomon really cares about diversifying the mix of people at Goldman. "Don't believe any of that," one former board member recently told a friend. "It's all window dressing." There is one aspect of being a boss that is clearly a personal passion for Solomon, insisting that employees enjoy a better balance between work and play. To attract the best and the brightest, he says, Goldman must continue to be a place where people work hard, but it's also got to be a place where people have opportunities to live their life and pursue other interests and invest in their families. In this area, Solomon has led by example. For starters, he's an adrenaline junkie. He cycles, he spins, he runs, he skis, he golfs, he kite surfs. He earned his wings at a kite surfing boot camp on the North Carolina coast. He scuba dives, he hikes. He's in the gym every morning at 6 with his trainer. He's been known to walk down the uninterrupted sidewalk on the east side of Central Park West on the weekends, wearing his headset, taking one conference call after another. "When I get interested in something, I try to do it at a very, very high level," Solomon says. "I like accomplishing things." Solomon's best-known passion is house music. At least once a month, he DJs in Manhattan dance clubs under the name DJ D. Saul. He has been an opening act for the legendary Paul Oakenfold, and he played with Liquid Todd. In June, he released his first track, a remix of Fleetwood Mac's Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. It debuted at number 39 on the Billboard Dance Mix chart. "Better than the original, for sure," one listener raved on YouTube. Where the thumbs up outpaced the thumbs down, 10-1. The same month, while he was attending the Brilliant Minds conference in Stockholm, the former Hearst executive Joanna Coles persuaded him to DJ on the boat that took the A-list attendees around a lake before dinner. "He was a very good sport about it," Coles says. "He's not your grandmother's banker. He's funny. He's charming." The side gig has come with an unexpected upside. Every time Solomon plays at a club, he says, Goldman employees come up to him and introduce themselves. "It's really humanized me in the firm," he marvels. "Young people approach me and talk to me in a way that they did not before this happened." In typical fashion, Solomon draws a management lesson from his nightlife. Whereas corporate executives used to be aloof and disconnected in their ivory tower, modern managers need to be willing to be a little bit vulnerable and exposed. It makes us more human and therefore better leaders. Solomon feels particularly vulnerable about the recent end of his marriage. His wife, Mary, left him suddenly about a year ago. "It's been one of the hardest things he's dealt with in his life," says his close friend Chris Nassetta, the president and CEO of Hilton Worldwide. Solomon and his ex-wife continue to do things with their two grown daughters. "We both feel sad that our marriage ended, but we remain close friends," he says. "It's not lost on me that a big part of the reason I'm here is the support she gave me over the 28 years we were together." Another of Solomon's passions is expensive wine, which he has kept in an extensive cellar in the family home in East Hampton. In 2016, in one of his most coveted purchases, he bought 7 bottles of Pinot Noir from Domaine de la Romanée Conti, considered one of the best and most expensive wines in the world, for $133,650. But the Domaine never made it to his wine cellar. One day a friend alerted Solomon that it looked like the pricey bottles he had purchased were showing up for sale online. Solomon confronted his family's personal assistant, Nicholas de Meyer, who was supposed to take delivery of wine shipments. De Meyer, it turned out, was really Nicholas Meyer, a Vassar graduate from Findlay, Ohio. For 2 years, according to a court indictment, Meyer had stolen hundreds of bottles of wine from Solomon, worth more than $1.2 million. Using the alias Mark Miller, the name of a well-known Hudson Valley vintner who died in 2008, Meyer allegedly had the bottles delivered to himself instead of to the Solomons, and then fenced them on the Internet. After agreeing to pay the Solomons back, Meyer fled the country. Last January, as he was returning to the United States, he was arrested at the Los Angeles airport. Released on a $1 million bond, secured by $200,000 in cash and his mother's home, Meyer has been trying to negotiate a settlement with prosecutors in New York. Solomon, meanwhile, is doing just fine. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.